Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Well, hey folks, and welcome to Solar Cabin Channel. I've got a neat little project for you I call the Multi-Shack. This is one of my homeless housing solutions designs. And some of you probably don't know this, but I was homeless twice in my life. The first time was when I was trying to get into college, and I had lost my job and was waiting for my college funding to come in, and so I had to live in my truck. I lived in the cab of my truck for almost 2 months while I waited for my college funding to come in. And then again later in life when I got divorced and didn't have a job and was trying to get off grid, I lived for almost 2 years in a camp trailer. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, homeless people that have their pride. They want to maintain their independence. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be caught up in the system. And, you know, all they need is a simple shelter. You know, some place to get out of the cold, to get out of the wind, to get out of the rain, while they get back on their feet. And so I know there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping the homeless, churches, nonprofits, and things like that. So I came up with this small structure design, which I call the multi-shack, because it has actually multi-uses to it. And it can be built very affordably. You can build this entire shack for under $200. And it is built on wheels. It can be put on either a 4x6 trailer, or you can build it on casters. Casters are a lot less expensive, but it still allows you to move this unit around. So you could store you know, a bunch of these on a church parking lot, and then just when you need them, you can move them out to wherever you want the person to be using them. Casters are 4-inch casters. Each caster will hold up to 240 pounds, so they'll more than handle the weight for this structure here. Now, this structure is 6'5" from the peak to the bottom, 6'5", so and even a tall person can stand upright inside this structure. The door is 1'6" wide and about 5'3" to the peak up there in the door. And the structure is 4 foot wide approximately and about 6 foot long. About 6 foot long by 4 foot wide, 6'5" to the peak. And this is constructed very inexpensively from 2x4 framing, which I'll show you, and uses, I would use 7/16 OSB or plywood. Either one would work for the siding on this. Now, a couple of the features here. I show this with dorm windows. The dorm windows are actually optional. You don't have to put dorm windows. You can just go with a flat roof surface if you want here. I show this with wood shingles, or you could use just plain old tar paper and roofing shingles. Any type of roofing shingles would work on this. Show it with a little flower box there just for effect. And on the backs and the front, I show this with these round windows, like boat-style windows, or you could put square windows. Either one works. I just like the effect of the round windows, the look of those in there. This does have an access panel on the back. Down here is an access panel. We'll just open this up so I can show you. Open up, take this one off. There we go. Now you can see inside the access panel. Underneath the seat and bed is storage, lots of storage underneath here for a propane tank, one of those Port-a-Loo porta potties, an ice chest over there you can see. Okay, so there's good storage. This is about 18 inches high inside here and about 4 feet wide inside. So the structure, I'll show this with the door open. Let me just hide this door here. With the door open, you can see I've got this set up. Right now I've got it set up for seating. During the day, this would be used for seating purposes, okay? And I'm going to pull the side roof off here so I can show you inside that this has a very nice space for a person that maybe is going to school or working, or just the table can be used for eating or whatever. So you've got approximately 6 feet of space on the inside here by 4 feet wide. And this table is actually part of the bed platform, which I'll show you. You just pull the 2x4 out, put it in one of these slots. It's in this 2x4 here. There's another one on the other side. You just drop the 2x4 into the slot, and then you take your bed panel and put it up on top of that, and then that becomes a table. Here you've got 2 foot by 4 foot cushions. There's three of these cushions that become your bed, or you can use a roll-up mattress pad underneath this that becomes your bed. But during the daytime, it becomes seating. It becomes a little mini couch in here, 4 foot wide. And now you've got a space for a student to do their studies, their work, or for having your meal, or if you're working on a hobby or a craft or something like that, you've got this nice little space. When you get out the door, you just lift the table up, put it back, put the 2x4 back in the bottom slots, put the table down, and you know, then you turn it into a bed. And I'm going to show you what it looks like as a bed, too. So, good headroom in this. I really like that it's got a very good space. This is an average person, 5'8" tall. You can see you've got lots of headroom here. You've got these nice dormer windows, which would give you lots of light, and also gives you a little bit more headroom up in this area right in here. A 6 foot person could stand up in the middle of this quite comfortably. Two people could actually share, sit side by side on this couch, or you can put in another, you could pull your ice chest cooler out, or someone could put a foldable chair on the other side here. So you could actually have two people sitting side by side or crossways next to each other here. So lots of space in this little place. So let me show you what the framing looks like on this first. And I'll just have to zoom in on this. Now this is all done with 2x4 construction to keep it inexpensive and easy to build. And then I would sheathe it with either 7/16 inch OSB or plywood. Either one would work. Now, it's got a floor frame, as you can see, made of 2x4s down here. Simple 2x4 frame, floor frame construction, and then your casters attached to the corners, not exactly in the corners, but they attach to the floor framing, and the casters have locks on them, so once you move this in place, you can just click on the locks and lock it in place so it won't be rolled around while the person is inside it. Now, this is the bed platform, and it has, this back platform is 2 foot 6 inches wide, and it is permanently connected. These are 1 foot 9 inch wide platforms that can be raised up, and as you can see, these 2x4s right here, you put the 2x4 up in these other slots, and then you put these panels up on top, and they become either a table or a workspace. This one can go up here. This one can go on the end. It can go over the middle. So I gave you lots of options for the ways that you can organize this into workspace or living space as you need to use it. Very simple construction. It takes about 20 2x4s to build this. That's about it. And you're looking at about under $200 for all the material costs. And you could build one of these in a day. Seriously, you could build the complete unit in about a day. And now I'm going to show you on the inside how this can be used as a bed and also as a small business. So I'm just going to click off this. Okay, now I show this with the bed down, the door open so you can kind of get a peek inside here. Now, this is an uninsulated structure. You really don't need insulation in a small structure like this because the human body puts off about as much heat as a 90-watt light bulb. So in a small structure like this, your own body heat will actually heat it up. And for sleeping, you can either do these pads like this as mattress pads, or you can just get a sleeping bag pad or even an air cushion pad to go underneath it. A sleeping bag pad would work fine because you can roll it up and use it as your seating. And a good heavy-duty sleeping bag would be all you would need in order to sleep very comfortably in here. As long as you don't have the wind blowing on you or the rain drenching you or snow piling up on you, you'll sleep very comfortably in a small structure like this. Your own body heat will heat it up. You could add a heater to these, but it really isn't necessary in these small structures. So I'm going to pull off the side roof, and I'm going to show you how much space this has inside it for a bed. It actually has a very nice bed that will sleep either one or two people. Pull this off here. Just hide this. Now, this has a 4 foot wide by 6 foot long bed. So even an average person can sleep in here. Even a tall person, fairly tall person, could sleep in here comfortably without being cramped. And it's 4 foot wide, so that's a very wide bed that will actually sleep two people. Two people could sleep in this space, all right? And it's 6 foot wide, and it's 4 foot wide and 6 foot long. This person I show in here is about 5 foot 8 inches tall, which is average height for most people. And here you can see the slots I was talking about. These platforms, which I'll show you, I'll take the bed off now. These two platforms are removable with 2x4s underneath them. You just take the 2x4, you put it in the slots that go across here, and then put these platforms up on top to make your table. And you can actually do a table on either end, or one in the middle for a desk and table. Now, the ones on the ends I'll show you are used if you want to run a small business out of here, or if you want to organize this in a different way so that if you're cooking, you could put one of these tables on this end or on this end, and you could set up your cooking supplies, and you know, you can take care of yourself. You can cook a meal inside this little place right here. So 4 foot wide, 6 foot long bed, and then very adaptable with these platforms of 2x4s. You can just put them up, and you can reorganize this any way you want during the daytime for whatever function that you're going to be using. Again, it has storage space underneath the bed and seating. You've got that nice access panel for you got storage underneath there. And I really like the space in here. This would be enough adequate space if in an emergency, let's say that a city has a disaster, a fire like they just had in Canada wipes out all these homes, or you have a tornado tear through a place, or you have flooding or something like that, which we've all seen in the news, happens all the time, and suddenly churches are overrun with people that don't have housing. You know, if you had a bunch of these sitting around that would sleep at least two people, you could pull these out in a small area. You could set these up and people would at least have shelter for, you know, survival until they can get into houses or shelter, bigger shelters or something like that. So that's another use for this type of structure here. So now I'm going to put the bed back on just to show you. And again, you can see this has really nice dormer windows. So you got really good light in this. And it's got an excellent sleeping space. It would be better for one person, but it would be adequate for two people. Okay? And, you know, if you got little teeny kids with you, you could put, you know, one adult and a couple of kids in there too. You know, there's enough space in there to sleep comfortably, and you've got lots and lots of headroom. You're not going to bump your head or anything while you're sleeping. Doorway, 1 foot 6 inches wide, 5 foot 3 inches to the top up here. So lots and lots of good space in this. Now I'm going to show you how this can also be modified to be used as a small business. Okay, one thing I know about people that are homeless is they're also very creative. And, you know, a lot of them actually run little businesses in order to support themselves. A lot of them do recycling. They recycle cans and bottles and other stuff like that. Or they pick up small appliances and stuff that they may find on the streets, or books or pictures or whatever, and they resell them, and that's how they support themselves. A lot of them are also very crafty people. They may make jewelry, or they may make wood crafts or something like that, or they may be artists. And so they have a way to support themselves, and so I think we ought to encourage that, because that helps them to develop sustainability. Not everybody is equipped to work in the regular workforce. Some people just aren't, but they're very industrious and can support themselves with a small business. And so I thought, well, this shack could also be used for setting up a small business. So what I did is I made this so that the window here can be hinged up, and I'll show this. The window on one of the dormers, or both, can be hinged up out of the way. And then you've got room here to put a sales counter or little platform here where this person is 5 foot 8 inches tall. A person can stand in this window and they can operate a small business. They can talk to customers, they can take money, whatever, working right out of this small shack. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be for homeless people. If you wanted to run a hot dog or hamburger stand, or sell your crafts or your books, or, you know, whatever you want to do with this, maybe it's a ticket stand, I don't know. This little shack could be very useful for a lot of different purposes. That's why I call it a multi-shack, is because it can be used for many different purposes. But this would be great for a homeless person that has a craft that they make, or recycle products or whatever. They want to sell them, they just hinge up the window, and they set themselves up a little business here to take care of customers. Now, this also shows inside how those tables can be reorganized. Here you can see I've lifted up the bed platform to put a table on this end, another table on this end, and you can use this for cooking in here. You can see I've got a little two-burner propane stove that you can set up on one of the tables up there, so you can do your cooking. You can work on your crafts. This table just lifts off, the 2x4 lifts off if you need to get access to the door. Lots of good headroom, okay? Workspace in there. This can be modified many different ways for many different people of however you want to use it. So a very functional space in there. All right, so that is the multi-shack, all right? And let me just then hide this so you can get a better view of it. Again, can be built very inexpensively. Around under $200 on casters, more expensive if you put it on a trailer. And I'm going to provide these plans for free because this is a project that I designed specifically for churches and nonprofit organizations to build shelters. And at present in the U.S., we have about 1.6 million homeless people that just need a simple shelter to live in. Or that's about one out of 200 people. And that's just in the U.S. There's a lot of people in other countries that are in even worse shape. And I really think a project like this would be great for helping the homeless people to have shelter while maintaining their independence and their pride, but it could also be used as disaster relief shelters. You know, there, we could easily have a major disaster in a city where we have thousands and thousands of people that suddenly are homeless, and we need to provide quick shelter. These would also work for that. It would be big enough space for two people to sleep and, you know, to take care of their basic needs, and that's what this structure is about. So I hope you like this design. It's called the Multi-Shack. You can get the plans for free on my website, simplesolarhomesteading.com. Up at the top, look at Multi-Shack. Now, there is a button there if you would like to donate. Your donations are used by me to design structures like this and build small houses. I work with a lot of homeless people that don't want to be in the system, that want to build their own off-grid cabins and houses and places like that. I help them with designs and building those projects. So any donation, if you can donate, is very appreciated and will help with those projects. All right, folks, I hope you like this project called the Multi-Shack, and have a great day.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Hi, my name is Kelvin Krushank Odape. My African dream is the KJOL since 2020. I saw a moving plane passing by and something told me to build a plane. So from that day, I started building an airplane. It led to a stage. When it reached to the stage, how I want the airplane to fly, I could.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I will be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch good, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't be hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. It's over.
What
I say it's over. Everybody
bitch
the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places, even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yi or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-WAC movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Construction. It's about 40% complete.
Alright, so this is the second Wafati that we have started construction on. People live in here off and on. People come and stay. They come from Airbnb or directly because they're familiar with our website. It keeps the water out. It's not insulated yet. So it can get cold, but the amazing thing is, like, it was going to be a warm day outside. But it's a little warmer outside, and we come in, and do you feel it's already much cooler?
Significantly.
So the thermal mass that surrounds the structure is absorbing.
Let's keep switching the identity to hide the people. Why don't we just keep renaming?
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? to teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Black America is potentially the most dangerous group of humans alive today. Dangerous to who? Dangerous to the corporate empire, Illuminati, imperial scum, whatever you want to call them, white supremacists.
White supremacy is the problem. You just happen to be white.
How much of the problems in the black community are the blacks' own fault?
Well, white supremacy is the main problem in our community. If we
How much of the problems are your own fault?
Excuse me. If we resolve white supremacy, we will resolve the problems of unemployment. We will resolve the problems of bad housing. The Reagan administration probably represented the epitome of white supremacy by cutting into every domestic livable program that whites and blacks had, especially poor people. And they showed their relationship with these people by proving their insensitivity.
Now, well, Mr. Cooper.
And the reason they're dangerous is because they're quite easily united. It might seem not true because there's so much division within black people in America, but the only reason they're divided is because the corporate empire spent billions of dollars keeping them divided because they are potentially dangerous.
Mr. Coakley, you've attacked Jesse Jackson, you attacked the late Mayor Harold Washington, you called them colorless. What black leaders, political leaders in this country do you respect?
Well, I think politics has a way of accommodation. I don't think we have true political leaders in the sense of that you're going to find purity in politics. Politics is about accommodation and compromise. When our black leaders go into politics, as was discussed recently in Harper's Magazine, blacks have to prove to whites that they will protect their interests first. That's why politics is not the type of game that we're going to continue to invest all our time in, because it's proven that it doesn't work. Politics will not whip white supremacy, but clear, accurate, documented challenges to white supremacy, as well as action, grassroots action, taken against the forces of white supremacy.
What makes them dangerous? Well, 45 million people united in the U.S. would be very dangerous. What kind of things is dangerous? Well, you might think I'm talking about protesting or getting together and rallying and that kind of stuff. Well, no, that's not the kind of danger I'm talking about. 45 million people united could do some serious damage to the financial market. Serious damage to the financial market. Serious damage to the financial market.
So I'm dark skinned with an accent, and when you had an accent back then, Africans, well, it wasn't that many Africans in America then. It was mostly Jamaican. So you had an accent, you're automatically Jamaican.
Right.
Africans, well, it wasn't that many Africans in America then. It was mostly Jamaican.
You have to be logical. If I know in this hotel room they have food every day, and I'm knocked on the door every day to eat, and they open the door, let me see the throwing food around, where they're telling me there's no food in there every day, I'm standing outside trying to sing my way in. We are hungry, please let us in. We are hungry, please let us in. After about a week, that song is going to change. That we hungry, we need some food. After 2-3 weeks, it's like, give me all the food, ragging out the door. After years, then you just like picking the lock, coming through the door blasting. We asked 10 years ago. We was asking with the Panthers. We was asking with that, you know, the civil rights movement. We was asking. You know, now those people that were asking, they're all dead and in jail. So now what do you think we're going to do?
What that was all about, the revolution will not be televised. That was about the fact that the first change that takes place is in your mind. You have to change your mind before you change the way you live and the way you move. So when we said that the revolution will not be televised, we were saying that, like, the thing that's going to change people is something that no one will ever be able to capture on film. It'll just be something that you see and all of a sudden you realize, I'm on the wrong page, or I'm on the right page, but I'm on the wrong note. And I've got to get in sync with everyone else to understand what's happening in this country.
To watch all of my exclusive content not featured here on my channel, log on to my website at imjustheretomakeyouthink.com/fumes.
Do you all believe as a race, I'm not talking about you specifically, but do you believe as a race, African Americans, we play the victim?
Hey, man.
I have a dream.
No. I'm just going to leave that as a one-word answer. I'm not even going to jump in deeper than that. No.
Yeah, I'm on the side of absolutely not. And I will leave it there until somebody disagrees.
Yeah. Then I'll jump back in. And now I'm going to step back.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm going to be real. I'm going to say yes.
Let's go.
I'm going to be real. I'm going to say yes.
Give me an example.
See, it's a loaded question just because I'm not going to sit here and say every single African American sides either on the yes side or on the no side.
Mm-hmm.
I say yes to mainly spark conversation, but also I know you're not talking, you said not personal experiences, but that's all I got to go on. I will say, you know, just based on where I am in life, I've gotten a lot of pressure from African Americans feeling like, you know, I've gotten to where I am because of white people or you can't speak, you didn't grow up like I did. Like I came from the hood, you know, I didn't have the same opportunities and privileges that other people had. And though, you know, I believe that to be true, in today's America, I really do feel like anybody has the opportunity to rise to the occasion. Now, is it easier for certain people over others? Yeah, I mean, let's be real, yes. Like, that's 100% true. But, you know, I just keep hearing, like, systemic oppression, this, that, and the third. Like, yeah, we get it. I know. Like, we all know. Like, we all know. But the opportunities are still there. Will you have to work a little bit harder to get to where you want to be? Absolutely. Because of how you look? Absolutely. I'm a testament of it.
Anybody gonna say nothing?
I want to hear this.
I think it's impossible to accuse us of playing the victim. You're talking about a 400 plus year head start for a particular set of people. You're talking about systematic oppression. That's what I meant by a post-traumatic state. Is we're at this stage in 2020. We're trained to say, yeah, it's unequal, but and that's just not okay to me. I don't think we should ever get to the place where we just accept inequality.
Correct.
I'm not encouraging stagnation, so I agree with you. I'm not encouraging throwing in the towel like, yo, it's not fair. That's not what I'm saying at all. But while striving to be your best self, you should never accept inequality. And I think that's what we're being trained to kind of just be like, yo, this is just the way it is, and to no longer call it out. And I'm not even saying we got to go picket, protest. I'm not saying none of that. But at least in conversations like this, if we're not going to set a standard, no standard's going to be set. Nobody else is going to stand it. Nobody else is going to set it. You're talking about, statistically, like factually speaking, at the onset of the 20th century, you're talking about landowners only giving land to specific races. That's generational wealth.
Yeah.
You're talking about bank loans only being given to specific races.
How can you?
That's generational wealth.
Correct.
So we can't. It's not even like this is ancient history. That's what blows my mind. This is recent history.
But he didn't say that that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was, "Do we play the victim?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very different. You're aware of the things that have happened, but are you victimized as a result of it?
So,
do you say, this is what I can do with what I have been allotted or whatever my place in life is? Are we playing the victim is the question.
Well,
yes,
I think we have to define play the victim.
Okay.
I think we are the victim.
Because anybody can be a victim.
I think we are factually a victim.
Through all races
so
can
what,
be victims.
What are we calling playing the victim?
What do you see that as then?
What do I see that as?
Playing the victim, like when you hear that, like what does that trigger for
play,
you?
Play the victim means I'm acting like something is being done to me that's not being done
or
to me.
Or always complaining.
That's what I hear.
Always complaining
that's what
about
I hear
our history.
That's what I hear when I hear play the victim. Like you're taking the position that something being done to you and nothing's being done to you. That's somebody playing the victim to me.
This is what I
and
hear.
And that's not the case to me.
This
you know
is
what I mean?
I hear.
Yeah.
Get over slavery. Stop talking about it. We're all equal now. You should be ahead. You should be further than where you're at. Stop talking about the old days. I'm gonna stop right there.
Yeah,
that's what it triggers in my head.
Mm-hmm. So to say like we can't. I don't think you can outrule or like just say, hey, some black people aren't playing the victim because everyone uses excuses.
Correct.
And people can be playing the victim by whatever excuse they may bring. But like you said, like we weren't given an opportunity basically to build that generational wealth. And without that opportunity, we don't own anything. So we are having to kind of look for employment like at wherever you work. And even you said there's one person at D1 that's black. And we're 15% of the nation. That's not an accurate representation of America. So therefore, we may not be playing the victim, but we're getting hurt in corporate America or wherever part of life.
That's kind of just statistics.
I'm going to agree with him. You know, I also don't like the term playing the victim because it does sound like you're alluding to something that is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
mm-hmm.
if we, you know, I'm not dismissing or negating the effects of 400 years of oppression.
Sure.
And, you know, the things that we've seen and been through. I'm not dismissing any of that. But if we cut it all off and we started with a year ago, we are still being victimized by the stuff you have to see on TV. You have African-American boys who at the age of 11 or 12, all they have ever seen were African-American boys being killed on TV.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they've ever seen. They've not known the life without it because they've watched this happen since they've been old enough to understand.
Mm-hmm.
They are victims. You can go into a grocery store. You can go into an amusement park. You can go anywhere and be mistreated, and you'll be a victim today. We're not talking about the victimization only of the yesteryears. You can be a victim tomorrow. And I think if we're all honest, we have been in places where you have been the victim.
That's right.
You were either wrongly accused or wrongly criticized or maybe let's not even make it a negative thing. Looked over for a job unjustly. It's happening. So there's a rationale to the relevancy of still being victimized.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I was to her point, it's not even like this is ancient history. We're talking about 1960s, 1970, like the Civil Rights Act was just passed halfway through the 20th century. Like it's not even hundreds of years ago. Like there are people alive still, like you know what I mean, who went through segregation that are still alive. Like it's not even,
of course.
You know what I mean? It's not even ancient history. So I can never agree that the responsibility is on us to fix the mistakes of others. I could never agree with that. I just can't.
And it doesn't take away, you know, something that I said on the back end of my last answer. At some point, as a family, as a community, you can gather the people you love and say, let's get us out of
this.
And then you could say, well, we're no longer playing the victim. We took pride and took our own responsibility. And then you can build all that up, and tomorrow you can go somewhere and still be disrespected.
To that point, in my initial answer to you, I said I'm not making an excuse for stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not no excuse to be stagnant.
Yeah.
It's not no excuse to not grind and
absolutely
hustle and get out here and get it. But even if his question is about us as a race and as a culture,
mm-hmm,
and if I get my family together and pull my family up, that's my family.
Exactly.
You feel me?
That's right.
That's not balancing the scales.
That's right.
You know
and
what I'm
it's,
saying?
It's very interesting. Your point is very, very interesting because I could be an extremely successful black man in today's America and still go somewhere tomorrow and be looked down upon
because of what I look like.
So I was going to ask you, because I remember like Booker T. Washington, like the 1890s, to like kind of offset the Jim Crow laws. He was
not
like,
saying
hey,
I'm that old, right? He's not trying to give me some
you remember
sexual
him, right?
Yeah. I'm the historian.
He said basically
the migration that much, so for real.
I was going to ask you this. So you said basically to offset the Jim Crow laws that were put in place, we had to educate and be entrepreneurs. And you two have both done that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear your experience, because this is, 130 years later for him saying, hey, we need to mobilize on our own, get education, and be entrepreneurs. And that will create our own system of wealth. But, I mean, you're only one person. It's hard to pull up a whole group.
Of course.
So I'd kind of like to hear y'all's experience as being entrepreneurs.
You can talk many hours.
I was going to let you go first.
Simone owns her own shop, too, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Listening right now.
Well, like I said, I was kind of raised in an entrepreneurial family, right? I was always taught, don't work. I'll just be honest, my father, don't work for the white man. That was it, right? You get education, anything you can take, put it towards your own business. Put your own 2 feet on the ground. Save your money. You know, get a hustle. You know, he's showing me all these things to do. So it was always in my mind that I had to work for myself. The only way I'm going to come up is to work for myself. So I was never trained to, you know, you're going to get a great education, then you're going to go get a great job, and then you're going to be successful, then you're going to raise a family. No, it was out. Go get your own brand. Raise your family. Give your brand to your family.
Mm.
Let them continue that generational wealth. So that's the way I was taught.
Mm.
And that's the way I got to keep it moving.
Okay.
Rephrase the question that you had specifically.
Basically, what I was saying is Booker T. Washington said to offset any type of segregation or discrimination or from playing the victim, we need to educate and be entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Has that experience kind of helped you push through, and have you been able to bring others up because of your entrepreneurship?
Okay, so thank you for that question. I definitely believe that entrepreneurship is freedom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's ultimate freedom. I was writing down a thought just yesterday as I was flying through Chicago that one sign of enslavement is a name change. That when people say that you're something, that you're not. So if I was to, like, go and address the same idea with biblical characters, we could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Mm-hmm.
That was not their name.
Yes.
It was their name that they were given in enslavement. And I can just imagine how they were in a room together, and you know, one of them yelled, hey, Shadrach, dude, that is not my name. I'm Toby. you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I feel like... Like, we have a responsibility to know who we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a responsibility to do our due diligence to make our name great. That somebody can walk around and call you a liar. Is that who you are?
Yeah.
That's not who you are. Somebody can walk around and call you a thief. Is that who you are? That's the name that the enslavement.
Yeah.
Has given you, right? And so I think that the only way that we can exercise true freedom is in ownership of our stuff, of ourselves, of our actions, of the things that we create, that we can be makers. I think that this is the time for all hustlers to unite, you know, that we all can make whatever we want to be a part of. We no longer have to sit back and say, oh, it's because of what you did to me. Listen, I was molested as a child. So if we want to go back and talk about victimization of the things that people have done to us, we can do that. Or we can rise above it and we can say, well, this is who I am now. This is what I'm going to do. When I started my business, I could not bake, not even out of a box. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit. I didn't have any experience in the business. Nobody was going to give me a loan for anything. I was losing the house that the very bakery exists in right now, 11 years later. Because when you put your mind, this is what I was saying earlier, we can be focused on what happened for us instead of what has happened to us. I believe that it is that blood running through my veins that had things taken from her. You know, it is that blood running through my veins that said, no, you can't come in here. It's that blood that is running through my veins that made my great-grandfather one of the first to be able to sing where he sang. And those are the things that I'm using today to get me from where I am to where it is that I want to be. And it's those things that I'm giving to my children and saying, this is what you have. We're not talking about what we're not. We're talking about what we are. Mm. And I think that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about what we are, what are we doing right as a culture that's setting up our children to have wealth? What are we doing right as a culture to where our children's children will know our names? Are we doing things right as a culture to change the narrative of our finances of our children?
I can only answer that as an individual and then see what we and my wife also try to do and spread, right? You know, we're all about giving back. We're all about showing and proving. You know, I want to be that beacon that the young brother say, you know what? I want to do what he's doing. You know what I'm saying? I want to go out and get my own wealth. I want to start my own business. And if I wasn't there, maybe he didn't see me. Maybe he never came to my restaurant. Maybe it's just me, you know, but when you're there, we're going to teach you. We're going to give you tools. We're going to teach you about customer service. We're going to teach you how to run a restaurant because that's what we have to do. It's my duty. I have to teach. And again, I can only speak about me. I can't save the world. Yeah. I can save the people that watch me. I can save the people that touch me. I can save the people that work for me. I do my best, right? You know, so, you know, I just look at it as you have to be that beacon, right? You got to be that shining light to change everything around you. You know, be that leading example.
But I don't think that's anything new under the sun, what you're saying.
No, it's not new.
I think that's what this community has been. You know, it has been a community of people who say, I'll teach you how to do this.
What community are you talking about?
The Black community. Has gone. I have plenty of examples in my life of people who stuck their foot in the door so that I could pass through.
That's not always out the way we do things, though. You know.
I'd like to tell you about the strangest secret in the world. Not long ago, Albert Schweitzer, the great doctor and Nobel Prize winner, was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him, "Doctor, what's wrong with men today?" The great doctor was silent a moment, and then he said, "Men simply don't think." And it's about this that I want to talk with you. We live today in a golden age. This is an era that man has looked forward, dreamed of, and worked toward for thousands of years. But since it's here, we pretty well take it for granted. We in America are particularly fortunate to live in the richest land that ever existed on the face of the earth, a land of abundant opportunity for everyone. But do you know what happens? Let's take 100 men who start even at the age of 25. Do you have any idea what will happen to those men by the time they're 65? These 100 men who all start even at the age of 25 believe they're going to be successful. If you asked any one of these men if he wanted to be a success, he'd tell you that he did. And you'd notice that he was eager toward life, that there was a certain sparkle to his eye, an erectness to his carriage, and life seemed like a pretty interesting adventure to him. But by the time they're 65, one will be rich, four will be financially independent, five will still be working, 54 will be broke. Now think a moment. Out of the 100, only five make the grade. Why do so many fail? What has happened to the sparkle that was there when they were 25? What's become of the dreams, the hopes, the plans? And why is there such a large disparity between what these men intended to do and what they actually accomplished? When we say about 5% achieve success, we have to define success. And here's the definition. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. Success is the progressive realization of a worthy ideal. Rollo May, the distinguished psychiatrist, wrote a wonderful book called Man's Search for Himself. And in this book, he says, the opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice, it is conformity. And there you have the trouble today. It's conformity. People acting like everyone else, without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. Now think of it. In America right now, there are over 14 million people 65 years of age and over. And about 13 million of these 14 million are broke. They're dependent on someone else for life's necessities. Now, we learn to read by the time we're 7. We learn to make a living by the time we're 25. Usually, by that time, we're not only making a living, we're supporting a family. And yet, by the time we're 65, we haven't learned how to become financially independent in the richest land that has ever been known. Why? We conform. And the trouble is that we're acting like the wrong percentage group, the 95% who don't succeed. Now, why do these people conform? Well, they don't know, really. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. They're outer-directed people. A survey was made one time that covered a lot of men, working men, and these men were asked this question. Why do you work? Why do you get up in the morning? 19 out of 20 had no idea. If you ask them, they'll say, everyone goes to work in the morning. And that's the reason they do it, because everyone else is doing it. Now let's get back to our definition of success. Who succeeds? The only man who succeeds is the man who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the man who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. I'll tell you who the successful people are. A success is the school teacher who's teaching school because that's what she wanted to do. The success is the woman who's a wife and mother because she wanted to become a wife and mother and is doing a good job of it. The success is the man who runs the corner gas station because that's what he wanted to do. The success is the successful salesman who wants to become a top-notch salesman and grow and build with his organization. A success is anyone who is doing deliberately a predetermined job because that's what he decided to do deliberately. But only one out of 20 does that. That's why today there isn't really any competition unless we make it for ourselves. Instead of competing, all we have to do is create. Now, for 20 years, I looked for the key which would determine what would happen to a human being. Was there a key I wanted to know which would make the future a promise that we could foretell to a large extent? Was there a key that would guarantee a person's becoming successful if he only knew about it and knew how to use it? Well, there is such a key, and I've found it. Have you ever wondered why so many men work so hard and honestly without ever achieving anything in particular, and others don't seem to work hard and yet seem to get everything? They have the magic touch. You've heard them say that about someone. Everything he touches turns to gold. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful? And on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who is a failure tends to continue to fail? It's because of goals. Some of us have them, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. Now think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it will take. It has a definite goal. 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it, or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it will either sink or wind up on some deserted beach, a derelict. It can't go any place because it has no destination and no guidance. It's the same with a human being. Take the salesman, for example. There is no other person in the world today with the future of a good salesman. Selling is the world's highest paid profession, if we're good at it, and if we know where we're going. Every company needs top-notch salesmen, and they reward those men. The sky is the limit for them. But how many can you find? Someone once said, the human race is fixed, not to prevent the strong from winning, but to prevent the weak from losing. The American economy today can be likened to a convoy in time of war. The entire economy is slowed down to protect its weakest link, just as the convoy had to go at the speed that would permit its slowest vessel to remain in formation. That's why it's so easy to make a living today. It takes no particular brains or talent to make a living and support a family today. So we have a plateau of so-called security, if that's what a person's looking for. But we do have to decide how high above this plateau we want to aim for. Now let's get back to the strangest secret in the world, the story that I wanted to tell you today. Why do men with goals succeed in life, and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You'll suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line. And from now on, you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success, and the key to failure. We become what we think about. Now let me say that again. We become what we think about. Throughout all history, the great wise men and teachers, philosophers and prophets have disagreed with one another on many different things. It is only on this one point that they are in complete and unanimous agreement. Listen to what Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman emperor, said. He said, "A man's life is what his thoughts make of it." Disraeli said this, "Everything comes if a man will only wait. I have brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment." Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "A man is what he thinks about all day long." William James said, "The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind." And he also said, "We need only in cold blood act as if the thing in question were real, and it will become infallibly real by growing into such a connection with our life that it will become real. It will become so knit with habit and emotion that our interest in it will be those which characterize belief." He also said this, "If you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. If you wish to be rich, you will be rich. If you wish to be learned, you will be learned. If you wish to be good, you will be good. Only you must then really wish these things, and wish them exclusively, and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly." In the Bible you read, in Mark 9:23, "If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth." Dr. Norman Vincent Peale said this, "This is one of the greatest laws in the universe. Fervently do I wish I had discovered it as a very young man. It dawned upon me much later in life, and I've found it to be one of the greatest, if not my greatest discovery, outside of my relationship to God. And the great law, briefly and simply stated, is that if you think in negative terms, you'll get negative results. If you think in positive terms, you will achieve positive results. That is the simple fact, which is at the basis of an astonishing law of prosperity and success. In three words, believe and succeed." William Shakespeare put it this way, "Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt." George Bernard Shaw said, "People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them." Well, it's pretty apparent, isn't it? And every person who discovered this for a while believed that he was the first one to work it out. We become what we think about. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about. And we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration, fear, anxiety, and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now, how does it work? Why do we become what we think about? Well, I'll tell you how it works, as far as we know. Now, to do this, I want to tell you about a situation that parallels the human mind. Suppose a farmer has some land, and it's good, fertile land. Now, the land gives the farmer a choice. He may plant in that land whatever he chooses. The land doesn't care. It's up to the farmer to make the decision. Now, remember, we're comparing the human mind with the land, because the mind, like the land, doesn't care what you plant in it. It will return what you plant, but it doesn't care what you plant. Now, let's say that the farmer has two seeds in his hand. One is a seed of corn, the other is nightshade, a deadly poison. He digs two little holes in the earth and he plants both seeds, one corn, the other nightshade. He covers up the holes, waters, and takes care of the land, and what will happen? Invariably, the land will return what is planted. As it's written in the Bible, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap." Remember, the land doesn't care. It will return poison in just as wonderful abundance as it will corn. So up come the two plants, one corn, one poison. Now, the human mind is far more fertile, far more incredible and mysterious than the land, but it works the same way. It doesn't care what we plant. Success? Failure. A concrete, worthwhile goal? Or confusion, misunderstanding, fear, anxiety, and so on. But what we plant, it will return to us. You see, the human mind is the last great unexplored continent on the earth. It contains riches beyond our wildest dreams. It will return anything we want to plant. Now you might say, well, if that's true, why don't people use their minds more? Well, I think they've figured out an answer to that, too. Our mind comes as standard equipment at birth. It's free. And things that are given to us for nothing, we place little value on. Things that we pay money for, we value. The paradox is that exactly the reverse is true. Everything that's really worthwhile in life came to us free. Our mind, our soul, our body, our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions, our intelligence, our love of family and children and friends. All these priceless possessions are free, but the things that cost us money are actually very cheap and can be replaced at any time. A good man can be completely wiped out and make another fortune. He can do that several times. Even if our home burns down, we can rebuild it, but the things we got for nothing, we can never replace. The human mind isn't used merely because we take it for granted. Familiarity breeds contempt. It can do any kind of job we assign to it, but generally speaking, we use it for little jobs instead of big, important ones. Universities have proved that most of us are operating on about 10% of our abilities. Decide now, what is it you want? Plant your goal in your mind. It's the most important decision you'll ever make in your entire life. Do you want to be an outstanding salesman, a better worker at your particular job? Do you want to go places in your company, in your community? All you've got to do is plant that seed in your mind. Care for it. Work steadily toward your goal, and it will become a reality. It not only will, there's no way that it cannot. You see, that is a law, like the laws of Sir Isaac Newton, the laws of gravity. If you get on top of a building and jump off, you'll always go down. You'll never go up. And it's the same with all the other laws of nature. They always work. They're inflexible. Think about your goal in a relaxed, positive way. Picture yourself in your mind's eye as having already achieved this goal. See yourself doing the things you will be doing when you've reached your goal. Ours has been called the phenobarbital age, the age of ulcers and nervous breakdowns. At a time when medical research has raised us to a new plateau of good health and longevity, far too many of us worry ourselves into an early grave trying to cope with things in our own little personal ways, without learning a few great laws that will take care of everything for us. These things we bring on ourselves through our habitual way of thinking. Every one of us is the sum total of his own thoughts. He is where he is because that is exactly where he really wants to be, whether he'll admit that or not. Each of us must live off the fruit of his thoughts in the future, because what you think today and tomorrow, next month and next year, will mold your life and determine your future. You're guided by your mind. I remember one time I was driving through Arizona and I saw one of those giant earth-moving machines roaring along the road at about 35 miles an hour with what looked like 20 tons of dirt in it, a tremendous, incredible machine, and there was a little man perched way up on top with the wheel in his hands guiding it. And as I drove along, I was struck by the similarity of that machine to the human mind. Just suppose you're sitting at the controls of such a vast source of energy. Are you going to sit back and fold your arms and let it run itself into a ditch? Or are you going to keep both hands firmly on the wheel and control and direct this power to a specific, worthwhile purpose? It's up to you. You're in the driver's seat. You see, the very law that gives us success is a two-edged sword. We must control our thinking. The same rule that can lead a man to a life of success, wealth, happiness, and all the things he's ever dreamed of for himself and his family, that very same law can lead him into the gutter. It's all in how he uses it, for good or for bad. This is the strangest secret in the world. Now, why do I say it's strange, and why do I call it a secret? Actually, it isn't a secret at all. It was first promulgated by some of the earliest wise men, and it appears again and again throughout the Bible. But very few people have learned it, understand it. That's why it's strange, and why, for some equally strange reason, it virtually remains a secret. I believe that you could go out and walk down the main street of your town and ask one man after another what the secret of success is, and you probably wouldn't run into one man in a month who could tell you. Now, this information is enormously valuable to us, if we really understand it and apply it. It's valuable to us not only for our own lives, but the lives of those around us, our family, employees, associates, and friends. Life should be an exciting adventure. It should never be a bore. A man should live fully, be alive. He should be glad to get out of bed in the morning. He should be doing a job he likes to do because he does it well. One time I heard Grove Patterson make a speech, the editor-in-chief of the Toledo Daily Blade, and as he concluded his speech, he said something that I've never forgotten. He said something like this: "My years in the newspaper business have convinced me of several things, among them that people are basically good, and that we came from someplace, and we're going someplace. So we should make our time here an exciting adventure. The architect of the universe didn't build a stairway leading nowhere. And the greatest teacher of all, the carpenter from the plains of Galilee, gave us the secret time and time again. As ye believe, so shall it be done unto you." I've explained the strangest secret in the world and how it works. Now I want to explain how you can prove to yourself the enormous returns possible in your own life by putting this secret to a practical test. I want you to make a test that will last 30 days. Now, it isn't going to be easy. If you'll give it a good try, it will completely change your life for the better. Back in the 17th century, Sir Isaac Newton, the English mathematician and natural philosopher, gave us some natural laws of physics which apply as much to human beings as they do to the movement of bodies in the universe. Now, one of these laws is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Simply stated, as it applies to you and me, it means we can achieve nothing without paying the price. The results of your 30-day experiment will be in direct proportion to the effort you put forth. To be a doctor, you must pay the price of long years of difficult study. To be successful in selling, and remember that each of us succeeds to the extent of his ability to sell, selling our families on our ideas, selling education in schools, selling our children on the advantages of living the good and honest life, selling our associates and employees on the importance of being exceptional people, to, of course, the profession of selling itself. But to be successful in selling our way to the good life, we must be willing to pay the price. Now, what is that price? Well, it's many things. First, it's understanding emotionally, as well as intellectually, that we literally become what we think about, that we must control our thoughts if we're to control our lives. It's understanding fully that, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. Secondly, it's cutting away all the fetters from the mind and permitting it to soar as it was divinely designed to do. It's the realization that your limitations are self-imposed and that the opportunities for you today are enormous beyond belief. It's rising above narrow-minded pettiness and prejudice. Thirdly, to use all your courage to force yourself to think positively on your own problem, to set a definite and clearly defined goal for yourself, to let your marvelous mind think about your goal from all possible angles, to let your imagination speculate freely upon many different possible solutions, to refuse to believe there are any circumstances sufficiently strong to defeat you in the accomplishment of your purpose, to act promptly and decisively when your course is clear, and to keep constantly aware of the fact that you are, at this moment, standing in the middle of your own acre of diamonds, as Russell Conwell used to point out. Fourth, save at least 10% of what you earn. It's also remembering that no matter what your present job, it has enormous possibilities if you're willing to pay the price. Now let's just go over the important points in the price each of us must pay to achieve the wonderful life that can be ours. It is, of course, worth any price. One, you will become what you think about. Two, remember the word imagination. Let your mind soar. Three, courage. Concentrate on your goal every day. Four, save 10% of what you earn. And action. Ideas are worthless unless we act on them. Now I'll try to outline the 30-day test I want you to make. Now keep in mind that you have nothing to lose by making this test and everything you could possibly want to gain. There are two things that may be said of everyone. Each of us wants something, and each of us is afraid of something. I want you to write on a card what it is you want more than anything else. It may be more money. Perhaps you'd like to double your income or make a specific amount of money. It may be a beautiful home. It may be success at your job. It may be a particular position in life. It could be a more harmonious family. Each of us wants something. Write down on your card specifically what it is that you want. Make sure it's a single goal and clearly defined. You needn't show it to anyone, but carry it with you so that you can look at it several times a day. Think about it in a cheerful, relaxed, positive way each morning when you get up, and immediately you have something to work for, something to get out of bed for, something to live for. Look at it every chance you get during the day and just before going to bed at night. As you look at it, remember that you must become what you think about, and since you're thinking about your goal, you realize that soon it will be yours. In fact, it's yours really the moment you write it down and begin to think about it. Look at the abundance all around you as you go about your daily business. You have as much right to this abundance as any other living creature. It's yours for the asking. Now we come to the difficult part. Difficult because it means the formation of what is probably a brand new habit. And new habits are not easily formed. Once formed, however, it'll follow you for the rest of your life. Stop thinking about what it is you fear. Each time a fearful or negative thought comes into your consciousness, replace it with a mental picture of your positive and worthwhile goal. There will come times when you will feel like giving up. It's easier for a human being to think negatively than positively. That's why only 5% is successful. You must begin now to place yourself in that group. For 30 days, you must take control of your mind. It will think only about what you permit it to think. Each day for this 30-day test, do more than you have to do. In addition to maintaining a cheerful, positive outlook, give of yourself more than you've ever done before. Do this knowing that your returns in life must be in direct proportion to what you give. The moment you decide on a goal to work toward, you're immediately a successful person. You're then in that rare and successful category of people who know where they're going. Out of every 100 people, you belong to the top 5. Don't concern yourself too much with how you're going to achieve your goal. Leave that completely to a power greater than yourself. All you have to do is know where you're going. The answers will come to you of their own accord. Remember these words from the Sermon on the Mount, and remember them well. Keep them constantly before you this month of your test. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. It's as marvelous and as simple as that. In fact, it's so simple that in our seemingly complicated world, it's difficult for an adult to understand that all he needs is a purpose and faith. For 30 days, do your best. If you're a salesman, go at it as you've never done before, not in hectic fashion, but with the calm, cheerful assurance that time well spent will give you the abundance in return you deserve and want. No matter what your job, do it as you've never done it before for 30 days. And if you've kept your goal before you every day, you'll wonder and marvel at this new life you've found. Dorothea Brand, outstanding editor and writer, discovered it for herself and tells about it in her fine book, Wake Up and Live. Her entire philosophy is reduced to the words, act as though it were impossible to fail. She made her own test, with sincerity and faith, and her entire life was changed to one of overwhelming success. Now you make your test for 30 full days. Don't start your test until you've made up your mind to stick with it. You see, by being persistent, you're demonstrating faith. Persistence is simply another word for faith. If you didn't have faith, you would never persist. If you should fail during your first 30 days, by that I mean suddenly find yourself overwhelmed by negative thoughts, you've got to start over again from that point and go 30 more days. Gradually, your new habit will form until you find yourself one of that wonderful minority to whom virtually nothing is impossible. Don't forget the card. It's vitally important as you begin this new way of living. On one side of the card, write your goal, whatever it may be. On the other side, write the words we've quoted from the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Nothing great was ever accomplished without inspiration. See that during these crucial first 30 days, your own inspiration is kept at a peak. Above all, don't worry. Worry brings fear, and fear is crippling. The only thing that can cause you to worry during your test is trying to do it all yourself. Know that all you have to do is hold your goal before you. Everything else will take care of itself. Remember also to keep calm and cheerful. Don't let petty things annoy you and get you off course. Now, since making this test is difficult, some may say, well, why should I bother? Well, look at the alternative. No one wants to be a failure. No one really wants to be a mediocre individual. No one wants a life constantly filled with worry, fear, and frustration. Therefore, remember that you must reap that which you sow. If you sow negative thoughts, your life will be filled with negative things. If you sow positive thoughts, your life will be cheerful, successful, and positive. Now, gradually, you will have a tendency to forget what you've heard on this record. Play it often. Keep reminding yourself of what you must do to form this new habit. Gather your whole family about and listen to what's been said here at regular intervals. You know, most men will tell you that they want to make money without understanding the law. The only people who make money work in the mint. The rest of us must earn money. This is what causes those who keep looking for something for nothing or a free ride to fail in life. The only way to earn money is by providing people with services or products which are needed and useful. We exchange our product or service for the other man's money. Therefore, the law is that our financial return will be in direct proportion to our service. Success is not the result of making money. Making money is the result of success. And success is in direct proportion to our service. Most people have this law backwards. They believe that you're successful if you earn a lot of money. The truth is that you can only earn money after you're successful. It's like the story of the man who sat in front of the stove and said to it, give me heat, and then I'll add the wood. How many men and women do you know, or do you suppose there are today, who take the same attitude toward life? There are millions. We've got to put the fuel in before we can expect heat. Likewise, we've got to be of service first before we can expect money. Don't concern yourself with the money. Be of service. Build. Work. Dream. Create. Do this, and you'll find there's no limit to the prosperity and abundance that will come to you. Prosperity is founded upon a law of mutual exchange. Any person who contributes to prosperity must prosper in turn himself. Sometimes the return will not come from those you serve, but it must come to you from someplace, for that is the law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. As you go daily through your 30-day test period, remember that your success will always be measured by the quality and quantity of service you render, and money is a yardstick for measuring this service. No man can get rich himself unless he enriches others. There are no exceptions to a law. You can drive down any street in America and from your car estimate the service that's being rendered by the people living on that street. Had you ever thought of this yardstick before? It's interesting. Some, like ministers and priests and other devoted people, measure their returns in the realm of the spiritual, but again, their returns are equal to their service. Once this law is fully understood, any thinking person can tell his own fortune. If he wants more, he must be of more service to those from whom he receives his return. If he wants less, he has only to reduce this service. This is the price you must pay for what you want. If you believe you can enrich yourself by deluding others, you can only end by deluding yourself. It may take some time, but just as surely as you breathe, you'll get back what you put out. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking you can avert this. It's impossible. The prisons and the streets where the lonely walk are filled with people who tried to make new laws just for themselves. We may avoid the laws of man, but there are greater laws that cannot be broken. An outstanding medical doctor recently pointed out 6 steps that will help you realize success. 1, set yourself a definite goal. 2, quit running yourself down. 3, stop thinking of all the reasons why you cannot be successful, and instead, think of all the reasons why you can. 4, trace your attitudes back through your childhood and try to discover where you first got the idea you couldn't be a success, if that's the way you've been thinking. 5, change the image you have of yourself by writing out a description of the person you would like to be. And 6, act the part of the successful person you have decided to become. The doctor who wrote those words is a noted West Coast psychiatrist, David Harold Fink, M.D. Do what all experts since the dawn of recorded history have told you you must do. Pay the price by becoming the person you want to become. It's not nearly as difficult as living unsuccessfully. Make your 30-day test. Then repeat it. Then repeat it again. Each time it will become more a part of you until you'll wonder how you could ever have lived any other way. Live this new way, and the floodgates of abundance will open and pour over you more riches than you may have dreamed existed. Money? Yes, lots of it. But what's more important, you'll have peace. You'll be in that wonderful minority who lead calm, cheerful, successful lives. Start today. You have nothing to lose, but you have a life to win.